What's up? It's Delaney, and I'd love to invite you to become an honorary co-host of the Self-Helpless podcast. Do you want to pick episode topics and guests? Done. Want to surprise your loved ones with shout-outs on the show for a birthday, project launch, a much-needed divorce? Whatever you're up to, would love to be a part of the celebration. Get your favorite and least favorite quotes featured on the podcast, submit questions for our special guests, and find lots more new features and surprises at patreon.com/selfhelpless. You'll also get added to our Patreon Insider email list to easily redeem rewards via a quick email reply. Because we know hanging out on Patreon isn't everyone's thing. You can also opt out of emails if you prefer to be a silent supporter of the show. And don't worry, we do not Scrooge McDuck these contributions. 100% of proceeds go directly to operating expenses that make this weekly podcast possible and available to all. Learn more at patreon.com/selfhelpless or simply click the link in this episode's description. Thank you for helping me fill the void of being the last standing host of the Self-Helpless podcast. Thank you so much.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm no good at taking good advice, and I'm self-careless, so don't tell me twice that lately I've been so stuck in my head that I forget just about everything my therapist said. Maybe I'm self-helpless. Maybe I'm self-helpless. Maybe I'm self-helpless. Maybe we are all self-helpless.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Self-Helpless. I'm Delaney Fisher, and today I'm joined by the wonderful Nejwa Zabian, who is an author of several incredible works, including Welcome Home, Mind Platter, her new book, The Only Constant, and many more. And today we're talking about uncertainty, change, especially the kind of change that you don't choose or pick, where you do not feel in control, and how finding a home within yourself is really the key to navigating life's twists and turns. We also chat about Nejwa's process as a creative and writer when it comes to prioritizing concepts and uncertainty in the creative space even, and lots more. So here is my chat with Nejwa Zabian. Nejwa, thank you so much for being here today. I cannot wait to have this conversation with you. It's so needed.
I have been really excited for this episode, so let's get the conversation started.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so I would love if you could maybe start with a little bit about you, the work you mm-hmm. do, and why you do it. We'll go from there.
Yeah, so I'm Nejwa Zabian. I have been writing since 2016, at least that's when I started putting my writing into the world. And my story, long story short, is that my entire life I felt like I was out of place, like I didn't deserve to belong. I had so many experiences happen in my childhood while I lived with different relatives where I was made to feel that I was a burden and prioritizing me was just way too much. And so I always felt like I needed to hide myself and like I needed to hide that I had any kind of needs or wants. And obviously, as a child, you internalize that to mean that just because you're not getting those things, that that's just your life and you deserve it. So writing in my journal when I was 13 years old was the beginning of me feeling validated in any way. And I feel like now in retrospect, when I think back to it, it's probably because I was giving a voice to my thoughts and feelings. Right. And then, so I was born and raised in Lebanon. And then 3 years after I started writing in my journal in 2006, on my 16th birthday, I moved to Canada to stay with my family who was already here. They're all born and raised here. We just moved to Lebanon for a few years. And then when the final move happened, I just felt like I really had no inner sense of home. Like I it didn't matter where I was, which country I was in, whether my family was there or not, I always felt excluded. And so when I moved to Canada and had everything, all my familiar stripped away from me, I decided that I didn't want to write anymore, because writing meant that I was so aware of what I was going through, but also that I was helpless. Like there was nothing that I could do to change my situation. And that's usually what happens with feelings, right? That's why people run away from their feelings, because they're like, when I become aware of it and I feel like there's nothing I could do to change it or fix it, right, I kind of don't want to feel it. Right. Because running away feels safer, because you feel like you get that temporary distraction where you're like, everything's going to be fine, but then the feeling's still there. So I stopped writing for about 7 years. And then when I became a teacher, I met a group of young students who were refugees from Libya at the time. And they were my first group of students. And when I looked into their eyes, I could see my 16-year-old self who just arrived in this new place and felt like, I don't belong here. What am I doing here? And so when I saw that pain and struggle in them, something inside of me woke up and said, you need to be there for those kids. So I started writing again to help motivate them. And in a way, that writing started healing me. And so 3 years after that, 3 or 4 years, having some teachers in the school and some parents read some of those writings of mine that I was writing for my students, they were all like, we want them in one place. So I self-published my first book. I never saw myself as an author. Oh, wow. And the rest is history. And now I just published my sixth book. So that's a little bit of the beginning of my story. And I'm guessing with the rest of our conversation, we'll dive into the rest.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Do you feel like, you know, when you met all of these students, did you feel like your, I don't know, past feelings were validated because of what they were sharing?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. So that was like a moment of like, wait a minute, I was, mm-hmm. I don't know if you could share a little bit more about that experience.
For sure. Now that I think about it, I think that when I saw them, my inner child resonated with them, because now I was an adult, but I didn't heal my younger self. So there was, you know, when you meet someone and you can't explain it, but you connect with them on a certain level. Yeah. And I connected with their pain and with their struggle to feel like they were important, to feel like they deserved the seat at the table. They didn't have to fight for one. And it's so much easier for us to advocate for someone else than it is for us to advocate for ourselves. Like I was with my friend earlier, she was doing my hair and she was filling up the coffee machine and something fell in it. And immediately she said, I'm so stupid. And I looked at her and I was like, nope, we're not talking to ourselves this way anymore. I said, would you ever say that to me? And she teared up. She said, no, absolutely not. I said, see, I'm sure you weren't even aware of what you were going to say to yourself. Is just part of what we've gotten used to in speaking to ourselves. Cause I used to do that too. And I still catch myself. Right. So I find it's easier to learn how to love ourselves when we imagine ourselves as someone that we love. So back when I met those students, fighting for them was so much easier than having to fight for myself. And it really woke me up to what I needed to do, because there was an exchange of, as they were feeling validated, as they were, I could see it on their faces, I could see it in their energy and their level of participation in their classes and their level of energy when they came into school. When I saw that what I was doing was making a difference for them, it made me feel like, wow, this really is all I needed to do for myself, or all I needed someone to do for me. So working with them not only changed my life as a teacher and educator, but it changed my life as a human being. That really was one of the beginnings for all of this work.
So interesting. It's such a good point. It is so much easier to advocate for somebody else. And yeah, those external experiences can really just hold a mirror up to, you know, what it's bringing in inside or bringing out of you.
Yes.
I was going to ask, so after that experience with the students, what happened next? Like you obviously you were fighting for them, but also fighting for you kind of at the same time. What did you do to fight for yourself afterward?
So I think self-publishing the first book, Mind Platter, was the first thing I did because it felt like an act of persistence and telling the world around me, this is who I am. I've been hiding all those years because I thought my thoughts and feelings were too much and that they didn't matter. And that just simply expressing myself and asking for space, whether it's emotional or physical or, you know, wanting to be part of a friend group where I was respected and prioritized like everybody else. Like the one thing that comes to mind is the big friend group I had when I got into university. They always celebrated everybody's birthdays. They always pitched in to get a person like a good gift. Never did that for me, even though I always pitched in. Like things like that.
Yeah.
I actually wrote about that experience in Welcome Home. And I talked more about other experiences with friends that I had that shaped for me how important it was for me to, like, it's not about demanding space. It's about walking away from people who put you in a position where you have to demand space, you know? Yeah. It's different to like be in an environment where, let's say it's a workplace and you find yourself stuck in these meetings where everyone else is their opinions are being heard, their suggestions are taken, and you feel like you're not. Yes, absolutely demand space. And maybe with time you do need to move to another job, but sometimes systematic oppression doesn't work that way. Sometimes you do have to fight it as much as possible. But in life, in personal relationships and connections, my experiences taught me with friends, with family, with romantic partners, with community groups and religious groups, I just learned that you really need to break the bonds that hold you to a past inauthentic version of you. Mm-hmm. You really need to say, that's not for me anymore. And so after I put Mind Platter out into the world, it was my first step at saying, this is who I am. My thoughts and feelings are out there. I don't care about the people who are going to criticize me and say I'm too much and tell me I feel too much and I complain about things that don't really matter. And after that, and the success of that, which was one of the most organic things that happened in my life, I really did not expect that my writing would take off. I'm telling you, I didn't see myself as a writer. I self-published another book of poetry, The Nectar of Pain. And then I got a publishing deal for those two books and a third one, Sparks of Phoenix, also a book of poetry about the fall and rise that we go through after we go through pain and silencing and being made to feel like we don't belong and being made to feel like, you know, who do you think you are? And then after that, I switched to a new publisher who I'm still with to this day, and I'm very grateful. And I wrote my first self-development book, which was Welcome Home. And Welcome Home just, it was the first time that I wrote in long format, because Mind Platter was short pieces of prose and reflections about life. And Mind Platter really was all that's on my mind served on a silver platter. So it was just reflections, shorter pieces. Everyone was a page or two maximum. But with Welcome Home, I wrote about my struggle to find a home. And I tied it back to my very first TEDx talk, which was called Finding Home Through Poetry. And while I was on stage, this wasn't planned. While I was on stage, these words came to me and they went like, the biggest mistake we make is that we build our homes in other people. We build those homes and we decorate them with the care and love and kindness and respect that we want to come home to at the end of the day. That's why when those people walk away, those homes walk away with them, and all of a sudden we feel empty. But that emptiness doesn't mean that we have nothing within us. It just means that what we have, we put it in someone else. And if we could make it and create it once, we could create it again. And so the whole idea behind Welcome Home was to teach someone how to practically build a home within themselves and become that home for themselves. The only constant came after that, which was all about navigating all the changes in your life, whether they are ones that happen to you, ones that you choose for yourself, or ones that you need to make in order to live an authentic life. And I'll tell you one thing that I don't think I've said before in another interview. I would not have been able to write The Only Constant had I not written Welcome Home and the books before it. Yeah. It, because in The Only Constant, I opened up about so much in my life in terms of how it is that I actually released certain traumas from my body. How did I navigate my fear of abandonment? Because when we try to change our lives in any way, those fears, those traumas will creep up and say, whoa, what are you doing? This is really scary. Like, no, these are the limits that we draw right here. Because people struggle so much with, and I did too, not just people outside of me, but we all struggle with not doing what we know we need to do. Yeah. And we start judging ourselves and saying, well, maybe I don't want it hard enough. Maybe I'm not strong enough. Maybe this, maybe that. We start internalizing all these messages about why it is that we're not changing our lives and not doing the things we need to do. But that's not what it is. You have to be compassionate with yourself and say, in every moment, you truly are doing the best that you are able to do. Mm-hmm. You can't compare yourself to somebody else and say, well, they were able to do what's best for them. Why am I not able to do that? Well, you have a different story and you have a different experience, and your fears and your traumas are valid. Like, you need to remember that. So you have to be compassionate with yourself. And I say this so many times in The Only Constant, what's fueled by shame is sustained by shame, and what's fueled by self-compassion is sustained by self-compassion. So if you want to change your life, let self-compassion fuel it. Don't sit there and say, I'm going to motivate myself by hating the self that I have right now. I don't even want to be this person anymore. Well, you're abandoning a part of yourself that at some point in the future, when you reach that change, that goal that you want, this version of you is going to be demanding that you apologize. It's going to be demanding that you come back and tell them that they're worthy. And so I wrote in such an open and raw way because I wanted everybody to know that change isn't this glamorous, easy, simple thing where it's like, oh, I have the answer. And once you follow this formula, it's going to be easy. No, change is, it's simple, but it's not easy. Mm-hmm. So you have to be willing to go through the waves that change is going to put you through. And when I was writing it, these three themes emerged for me, and a little bit of a backstory for why I even wrote a book about change. First of all, with Welcome Home, I opened up a lot about my personal life, but I felt like I was ready to talk about a lot more about how I broke certain trauma bonds and how I really came to be who I am as a person, because I'm an empath by nature. I'm a people pleaser. It's a very huge trauma response I've developed over the years.
Same.
I have a hard time sensing that I displeased someone or that I'm not what they want me to be. I struggled with, I'm not going to say letting go of that identity because it's still part of me, but I struggled with embracing that identity, but learning how to set boundaries at the same time and learning that a person who genuinely loves me and cares about me will never put me in a position where I have to explain to them why I'm saying no when saying no is in my best interest.
Right. Right.
So yeah. With The Only Constant, I documented all of that. And so here's a backstory. So I signed a book deal, a two book deal after Welcome Home, which is great. And I'm so grateful. And the first book was, the rough idea was that it's about navigating like transitions in life, maybe ending school and starting real life and, you know, ending a relationship and being single or being single, getting into relationships, stuff like that. Because I was coming to the end of my doctorate program. And it was the first time in my life that I was not going to be working toward this big, you know, accomplishment. I had been doing that my entire life. Like, there's one, I was going to say section of my life.
there's one chapter.
Well, there's one chapter of my life. I was 22 years old. It was the year that I became a teacher. 21, 22, I was doing my master's full-time. I was teaching full-time. I was tutoring 7 days a week, teaching on Saturday school at the International Languages School, and working with my brothers at their car dealership. And I still thought I wasn't doing enough.
Yeah.
And I call that period of my life the car crash period, because I actually crashed my car during that time. And it was such a huge wake-up call for me, but I didn't take it as a wake-up call. I took it as, oh, I'm just not managing my time perfectly. I need to be focusing more on my work. And it was like, I was doing things that some people take time off work to finish their program in school, but I was doing a program full-time. And I had to write not a thesis, but a capstone thesis, which was not as research intensive, but it was still pretty huge. And I was doing so much. I was sleeping like 3 hours a night. And I still thought it wasn't enough. And then not surprisingly, my body said, well, you're not going to listen. I'm going to make you listen. And that same year, I was diagnosed with Crohn's.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So that's like 10, 12 years, I would say, before that point in my life where I was approaching the end of my doctorate program. So that gives you an idea of the kind of person I was, or what I thought made me enough. And it was doing, proving, having things to say, I'm doing all of this stuff. And I don't judge myself for that. That's how I was raised. That's how my family and society raised me, is you need to be a hard worker. You need to accomplish these things. You're smart. Like, don't waste time. Don't have fun. Don't do this. So I'm approaching the end of my doctorate. I've already started doing the work to understand that it's not that I do, therefore I'm worthy. It's I am, therefore I'm worthy. I knew it on a logical level, but I was very aware that the moment I no longer had to wake up every morning and worry about the next assignment or my dissertation, that my body was going to be like, whoa, what are we doing? I'm going to panic. I'm going to go through the motions of, I don't know what it's going to make me feel like I'm actually accomplishing something in my life. And so I was approaching that. And at the same time, my grandma passed away. And that change was not one that I was ever ready for or ever wanted to be ready for. I was hit with a wave of grief that it made everything in my life that I thought was important, all the people and the things and the accomplishments, just kind of fall like dead leaves off of a tree. Like, it felt like nothing mattered. I had this beautiful, pure, unconditional love available to me, and instead of spending time with her, I was worried about all of these things and all of these people. Going through a change that I chose, which was to obviously no longer go further in school. I mean, a doctor is the furthest you can go. And a change I didn't choose, the death of my grandma, got me to reflect on what kind of life do I want to live, where in 30, 40, 50 years, when I look back, I say that's the best life that I could have lived. And to me, the best life is the most authentic one. Mm-hmm. And so these three themes emerged of changes we don't choose, like the death of a loved one, like a breakup, like getting laid off of work, like getting excluded from something you really want to be part of, whether it's community, religion, a friend group, changes that we do choose and changes we need to make in order to live an authentic life. And to me, obviously, the changes we choose, because there's an element of choice, it makes them a little bit easier on us because it's like, I've chosen that, but it's still difficult to go for changes that we do choose. But changes we need to make to live an authentic life, that's heavy. Mm-hmm. And changes we don't choose, that things that happen to us that we either didn't see coming or we did see coming, but we really don't want them. Those two types of changes to me were like, that is the meat, that's the flesh of the book, because I know that people struggle so much with that. And so I didn't want to just say, here's what you do. I said, this is what I did with these things. And I just sat in front of my computer every day. I wrote this book in 4 months, and I would sit in front of my computer, open up a Word document, voice to text, and sit, and I would just talk like I was talking to someone I love, like I was reflecting on my own life, like I was talking to a therapist or to a friend. And I just put it all out there. And mm-hmm. I want every person who reads it to know that even though we know that change is the only constant in life, we also have to remember that we are the only constant in our own lives. And so if there is one person who we need to trust in leading our lives, that's us. If there is one person that we need to tap into their experience and their story and validate them, that's ourselves. If there's one person that we need to give credit for all the changes that we make and all the hardship and all the pain that we've been through, it's ourselves. So when you take the time to invest in getting to know yourself and to invest in learning why it is that you spent all those years of your life operating from your survival mode and what the limits of your survival mode are and who taught you that and what moments do you need to go back to and speak to yourself as the adults in your life should have spoken to you? When you take the time to do all of that, not only will change become something that you embrace, but it will become something that you understand is the only way to get to the life that you actually want to live, where it feels like you are just being yourself. And mm-hmm. and I don't mean it. Sometimes when people hear me say, well, you're being yourself, like, what if that means you just don't want to do anything and you're just being lazy? That's, I'm not saying don't do anything and just lay down all day and don't do anything at all. But if a day comes where you need that for a day or two or a week or a few months because you went through something in your life that demands that you sit with it, mm-hmm. yeah, that's what you need to do.
Right.
I had a friend who was going through a difficult time. Just for her privacy, I won't talk about exactly what happened because I think it's such a specific thing that people would know who she is. Mm-hmm. But it was a really difficult time where she just really needed to rest. Like, her body needed rest.
Yeah.
And she was crying to me and she's like, I get up every morning and I need to get my work done and I can't. And I'm just so upset that this thing is taking away from what I want to be doing and what I need to be doing. And I looked at her and I said, I understand that, Have you considered that maybe this part of your life, maybe these few months, are about you slowing down and taking care of your body? Maybe that's what this part of your life is about. Maybe the most important thing in your life right now isn't that you do the work that you need to do, like your job. Maybe your body and your health is way more important than that right now. Like, maybe just consider that and think about it. And she was just bawling her eyes out. She's like, that's exactly what it is. Like, I've been running away from giving my body what it needs because I'm being hard on myself, thinking if I don't work, then something must be wrong with me. But really, all I want to do is rest, and all I need right now is rest. So
right.
To say that you're living your life in the way that you want, maybe it's the kind of life where you actually live life instead of expecting it to be this highlight reel that you see on Instagram, or instead of expecting it to be a certain way, you do what you can and you just let life flow and you flow with it.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry. I talk a lot.
It's all good. It's all good. I have a lot of questions for you.
Okay.
So number one, I mean, I'm resonating with this so much. I've been a chronic, overaccomplisher, overworker, all of the things. And, realize like, a lot of it was a trauma response of just doing, yes. doing, going, accomplishing things. And that's how I've lived most of my life. And I'm only in, a handful of years on the other side of it. It doesn't kind of go away overnight, even when you start to try to unravel your self-worth from your accomplishments. So number one, what are some things that have helped you do that? Like really try to separate your worth that stands alone from the things that you do. And then also the fact that you've been a people pleaser. How the heck did you get over that enough to put your work out there in such a public way about these very personal experiences, and knowing that anybody can read them and might, some people might be upset. Anything that you want to say about those?
So the first question I'll answer is, how did I detach my self-worth from my accomplishments? I went through a journey of self-discovery to understand why it is that every single time something really bad happened in my life, I felt like I was so creative in my writing. I was able to just be so hyper-focused on writing my thoughts and feelings out, and they would come out so much more beautifully. I was saying that to my therapist one day. Like, I'm still grateful for all the chaos that happens around me because it allows me to create such beautiful art. I'm laughing because what my therapist said, like, hit me like a lightning bolt. She said, but how beautiful would it be if you didn't have to have so much chaos in the background for you to create?
Right.
Like, what would it be like to create without having to tune something out, to tune a certain pain out, tune a certain environment out? So I needed to understand why it became such a familiar and normal thing for me to operate so well in my life despite all the bad things that were happening. And I understood that that was a survival mechanism of mine to achieve so that I could prove my worth in contrast to the environment. So once I understood that, I understood why maybe in some ways I sometimes subconsciously sought the chaos, and sometimes I subconsciously sought the unavailability of people and the struggle to connect with people. in order for me to achieve more so that I could prove that I deserve something, that I deserve someone, that I deserve love. So in diving into that, I understood that for all those years, I thought that what I did, because it was like a fight against something, it felt like an accomplishment and it made me somebody. But I had to connect with the part of me that was, wow, I'm getting really emotional. I had to connect with the part of me that was like, but like, what about me without that university degree and without having written that book and without having succeeded in the world in some way? What about me without all of that? Like, if I didn't have all of that, would I actually sit with myself and say, you're nothing? Mm-hmm. It's like that part of me that was just me, like my authentic self, my truth, just me without any label, I guess my soul was like, yeah, what about me? Like, do you not love me just as I am? Do you not think that I deserve the love that you tell everybody that they deserve? And so in speaking to that part of myself, I understood that it's not that I was born thinking that I didn't deserve to be worthy without all of these accomplishments. It was obviously a message that was given to me by my environment that if I don't achieve and if I don't prove that I deserve the people around me's love and respect and whatever, if I didn't earn it, then it really meant that I didn't deserve it. Like, I had to work hard for it. My environment taught me that. And so I had to go back to younger versions of me. And this took a lot of therapy, by the way.
Yeah.
And to go back to all these stories, like individual stories, and imagine in one case, for example, walking into the room where 8-year-old me was, and she was being excluded from like a family function with my aunt and uncle and cousins. I was living with them at the time, and they all went downstairs. We were all playing in the playroom, and my aunt came and took them and said, you stay here, it's family time. And I'm just listening to them opening gifts and being happy, and I'm sitting there thinking, why can't I have that, like the love, the happiness, the someone thinking about me to get me a gift? And so one of the things I did was going back to a story like that, like walking into that room as adult me and looking at my 8-year-old self and saying, do you want to be here right now? And saying, like, I'm sorry, they shouldn't have done this, and you deserve to be part of that. Like, do you want to walk out of this? And actually imagine walking her out of there and imagining taking her out on a date and buying her a gift. Like, I had to do all of that to understand that, to teach myself that I deserve to be treated properly, and I deserve love, and I deserve to be prioritized, and I deserve to be celebrated just for being myself. So in healing that, and I'm still doing the work, I've learned to look at my achievements not as something that carries the burden of proving that I deserve something, but more as something that I enjoy doing.
Right.
You know, that's why, like, when I reflect back on my earlier years in university versus the last few years after I started doing this work, because I graduated from my doctorate last year, but in comparing the beginning of that 10-year journey in university to the end, at the beginning, I was like, 70% of my struggle in school was the struggle of, if I don't pass this, if I don't do well, what are they going to think of me? I get people in, the only constant, I say, remember this word, they, because I'm going to get you to reflect on it. That's your audience. This leads perfectly into your next question, the audience. How do you...
Yeah.
do without thinking of the audience. And it's like, what are they going to think of me? They was my family, my friends who were with me in my program, my cousins, anyone in the community who, you know, looked at my family and the people who are in it. I felt like I had to keep a certain standard. And so 70% of my struggle was just, what if I don't do well at this? Instead of actually focusing on what I was learning, take me to the last, I would say, 2-3 years of my university career. I would say 95% focused on what I was learning instead of the 5%, which was, what if I fail at this? Like, what are they going to think? It's like I completely lost that audience, because I understood over the years and with all the work that I did that my reaching a certain goal was for me. It was for no one else. And if failing was going to get somebody to see me differently, then I don't want that person in my life. That's not somebody who sees me as a human. That's not somebody who is willing to sit with me during my struggle. And I surrounded myself with very few, because I think people look at social media and they think, look at that friend group and these people have each other and whatever. It really is most of the time a show. Don't get deceived by that. Because most people will have truly one or two really amazing people in their lives who are willing to not ever define them by what they do and how they do it and how well they do it and who they beat at it. They just look at you and see you as a human. Your accomplishments are just a bonus. They celebrate you when you do something and they sit with you when you're not doing so well, but they never make you feel like they're only your friend or your supporter just because of all the things that you achieved. So here's another thing I want to say about the audience part. Sorry, my nose is like, we just cried.
Oh, all good, all good. Crying is welcome here.
So there was one time a few years ago, this is when the whole audience thing kind of became not important to me. The negative audience, like the people who are going to judge you.
Right.
So I had spoken up about something that happened to me and it got a lot of backlash and I was being threatened legally and it was public. And I had one reporter ask me, aren't you afraid that you're going to get sued even more and that you're going to be criticized by all those people who don't believe you and that you're going to be accused of being like a person who's just who's disruptive and you just want attention on yourself? And I responded, and I honestly think that was my inner wisdom stepping forward in the moment because I hadn't thought of that question. And I said, yeah, you're right. Like, there are people who are doing that to me. And when I speak, I'm not thinking of them. I'm thinking of the person who's sitting in that dark corner, who's gone through something like what I went through, who's feeling helpless, who's feeling hopeless and like nobody's gonna believe them and that their feelings don't matter and they need to suck it up. I'm thinking when I speak, I'm speaking to them. So when you think of that audience that is gonna be critical and that's gonna judge you and that's gonna say, who the hell do you think you are to achieve something like that? Or you're so full of yourself just because you've done that one thing, blah, blah, blah. Actually, in the only constant, I just remembered this. There's two questions that I get people to reflect on saying there are people in your life who've asked you one of these two questions in a certain way. When you make a certain change in your life, like you let go of a certain part of your identity that they used to define you by, like being a people pleaser, like being a good woman, being a good wife, being a good daughter or son or whatever, the title that they think makes you who you are when you've like really let go of it. One question is, so you think you're special now? And the other question is, if you let go of that, what's so special about you now? So you have to be aware of the people who in some way ask you one of these two questions. So you think you're special now, or what's so special about you now? Because both questions are meant to make you feel ashamed. They're meant to focus on that one thing that you lost that served them, whether it served them directly or whether it served their comfort zone. Like, they're not somebody who wants to speak up. So when you speak up, you put them in a very uncomfortable position. And so they want you to feel bad about yourself so that they don't have to deal with having the courage that you just had and doing something so big. And so when you think of that audience, say, of all the people in the world that I could be helping with just me being myself and staying true to my purpose. And I'm not saying like all the people in the world as in have a large social media following. No, you can contribute to a better world just by living your life in an authentic way where you are not forced to be a certain way just to be accepted. Like, you live your life in such a liberated way. It's all a butterfly effect. If you do it, you are definitely influencing someone around you who's seeing you, even if it's your own kid, your sister, your brother, your friend at work, your friend in real life, your partner. There is something about centering our authenticity that is, it causes a wave of beauty in the world. It encourages the people around us to make that change as well. One thing I say in The Only Constant, two things actually: be the center of your attention. And I know people think that that makes you a very selfish person. It does not. Because remember, you are the only constant in your life. You better be the center of your attention. You better pay attention to how someone speaks to you, makes you feel. You better pay attention to how you feel in a certain environment. You better pay attention to the way you make people feel. Be the center of your attention. Take responsibility and own your choices, own your changes and your decisions. And the other thing I say is, let your world revolve around you. Mm-hmm. We think that if the world revolves around us, that we are so self-centered and we are so egocentric and we only think of ourselves. Sometimes letting the world revolve around you just means that it's not revolving around everybody else. Sometimes letting the world revolve around you means you lead your life. It means you decide what changes you want to make and which ones you don't want to. Sometimes letting the world revolve around you means that when something happens to you that you don't want, you sit with it. You don't just hear everybody's message of just get over it, or like, you're so much better than that. Like, who cares that that person left you or hurt you? No. Letting your world revolve around you means that you allow yourself to feel the pain that's inflicted upon you. You allow yourself to say, there is no pain out there that I'm too big for, especially if it's a pain that actually was directed at me. So when you live by those principles, you're that audience that's critical and judgmental and that's just waiting for you to make a mistake and waiting to sit there and, you know, talk about how you could have done things differently and how you could have done things better and how you shouldn't have even tried to go for something like that. They become irrelevant to you because they are attached to a past version of you that was self-abandoning and people-pleasing and just wanting to be seen a certain way. And so one of the things I talk about in the chapter on the changes that we need to make, I say, don't negotiate your change with people who want you to stay the same. And to me, that's such a big principle. do not negotiate your change with people who want you to stay the same. Usually the people who speak in that tone, that try to make you feel like you've just done something that's like, so why would you do that? Or just those people want you to be an inauthentic version of you. The reason they're giving themselves the right to comment or act as if they know better for you what you should have done, or they know better than you about that part of life or work or whatever, they're holding you to a past version of you that you are outgrowing or that you've already outgrown. And so keep reminding yourself that, yes, of course, it hurts when we feel like we've let someone down. It hurts when we feel like we're being judged, but feel the pain, but don't take it personally. And this is one of the things that drives me up the walls when I hear people say, don't take things personally. And then they proceed to say, you know, if someone says something to you that isn't true, just don't let it get to you. It's not true. Or if someone does something to you that's so hurtful, like that has a lot more to do with them and it has nothing to do with you. So just don't let it get to you. And it's like, okay, so if somebody like, you know, pointed a gun at me or an arrow at me and shot it at me or aimed it at me and it hit me, right, I can say that had nothing to do with me, but am I still not injured? Right. Do I not still need to heal this wound that happened? So when I say don't take it personally, because I also have that in The Only Constant, it's a deceptive section because you think that's what you're going to hear. Like, just don't like it, let people's behavior get to you. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying feel the pain of it. Feel the pain of the judgment and feel the pain of maybe I let someone down. I'm feeling excluded. I'm feeling like that little kid that just made a mistake. Feel it, but do not make it mean something about you. Don't say I deserve that they treated me that way, or because they treated me that way or they said that thing, maybe their truth is more important than mine. Maybe they're right about me more than I'm right about me. That's what I mean by saying don't take it personally. When you start mm-hmm. saying those messages to yourself and letting their treatment make you go back on something that you chose for yourself, that's part of taking it personally. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the pain that people throw at you and just feel it without trying to understand why they hurt you, because I say part of trying to understand is part of running away from feeling the pain. We think that maybe if we understand why they did what they did or why they said what they said, then it's going to make the pain easier, but it's not. You still have to heal the pain. So mm-hmm. I keep saying this, but there is absolutely no justification for somebody mistreating you or putting you down. So stop looking for the reason and actually look at the reality that they hurt you and feel it, whether they're people you know or people you don't know, and then make a decision moving forward. And don't tie whether that decision of letting them go was right or not don't tie that decision to whether you immediately find people after that who make you feel like you are okay, because you're going to go through a period of isolation after you let people go who are not good for you, because you are actually coming back to the essence and core of who you are. You're saying to yourself, I've just shed this layer of people who I wanted them to see me differently. I wanted them to be good to me. You will go through a period of isolation where after you shed that layer of yourself that used to people please and used to have a hard time not being your kind, empathetic self when you really need to set a boundary, you've just shed that very thick layer. So you're going to feel extra vulnerable after that, because now it's like you're in search of, well, who am I if I'm not that people pleaser? And who am I if I'm not attached to these people? And who am I if I now set boundaries and now I'm willing to be on people's bad side? So you go through a period of isolation, which I also talk about in The Only Constant, where I say that period of isolation is actually so good for you, because it allows you to kind of build and rediscover your own backbone. And it's not to say that you want to be isolated for the rest of your life or that you don't need people anymore, but maybe that period of time is what allows you to be that self-worthy person that you know you are. Maybe it allows you to discover who you are outside of who you're connected to and outside of what it is that you accomplish, so that when you start meeting people again in your life, whether it's at your work or your friends or people who you want to be your family or who could be your family, or romantic partners, business partners, whatever, you start prioritizing that you, as you authentically are welcome at the table. Not that a pretend version of you, like just accept me, you know, I'll mold into whatever you want. You start prioritizing that you are fully present at the table. And that's not possible without feeling that isolation that you feel after you let certain parts of your identity or what you thought was your identity go, and certain people go, and certain beliefs go, and certain thoughts go. You have to do that, and you're gonna feel the isolation. Even if you still have some really good people and really good things in your life, you're still gonna be focused on what you lost, and that's extremely valid. But don't see it as a negative sign or as a sign that you need to go back on this change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love your perspective on accomplishment and like our relationships with accomplishment. Because like, do you ever worry, or how do you decipher if, you know, you kind of went from, right, you got like your doctorate and you were really overworking and doing all these things, and now you're this very accomplished writer with all these like best-selling books and all of that. And so do you ever worry, like, have I just replaced my accomplishments with other accomplishments, and I'm worried I'm going to get wrapped up into the overworking or attaching my self-worth to external success, even if the work feels more authentic? Like, how do you navigate that, especially when you get like traditional publishing deals and there's maybe a lot of opinions about things? How do you ground yourself and center yourself with that? Because you're still very accomplished.
Yeah. I see the work that I do, and I'm very blessed that it is what I would do even if I didn't get paid for it.
Awesome.
Even if I didn't get the publishing deal, it is what I, because when I started, I was teaching, so I was making an income. So for me, writing was what felt like it liberated me.
Yeah.
And so now when I get into the, you know, like meetings with my agents or with my publisher or with my PR person or marketing person, I'm very blessed that all of them treat me like the human that I am. And getting to a point where I have a team like this wasn't like it didn't just happen. I had to work with people who I decided I didn't want to work with anymore. I had to set certain boundaries. I had to say, this is what's really important for me with this work. I will never post something that's not authentic to me. I will never hire somebody to write for me. And just because for me, my whole brand is, from the beginning, without even knowing what a brand was, is that I'm in touch with the people who are reading my words. And so my publisher knows that, all the people who I work with know that, my agents are extremely incredible, and they allow me to represent my work and to spread it in the world in the way that I want to. And so, yes, of course, we have meetings where we brainstorm ideas for you know, what kind of videos do I need to make and on what topics and what kind of articles could I write and stuff like that. There is that work element. And what I told you earlier about the conversation I had with my therapist, where I went from looking at my accomplishments as things that carry the burden of proving my worth, I now remind myself that this is something that I want to enjoy. And I, that way I'm just going to put my absolute best into it and not really attach whether it's an accomplishment or achievement to what it achieves for me. It's like the beauty is in doing that work. And so for anybody who's listening, if you do feel like you struggle with detaching who you are from what you do, even if you've reached a point where you feel like you're doing exactly what you've always wanted to be doing, I would say just tell yourself, my accomplishments do not carry the burden of proving my worth, and they do not carry the burden of proving whether I am a successful person or not. It's the work that I put into these accomplishments and what I feel and what I think and how I grow as I do this work that means something to me. And yes, life is real and you do have to worry about making money and providing for yourself. I understand that. I know that some people sometimes who derive an income from social media will say things like, you know, I just signed this brand deal, it doesn't really align with my brand, but I really need the money. If you feel like you are doing some kind of work at the expense of your authenticity or the authenticity of your brand, just think of the long-term effects that that might have, because inconsistency really has a bad consequence on your work. So it would be the same as taking on any other kind of job and saying, I'm doing this just to make money so I can supplement what I need. So there's always options that you can take where you can work other jobs until you feel, just to supplement this dream or this purpose of yours. And just that way you won't be put in a position where these accomplishments that you do with your main purpose become burdened with making an income for you, you know. Mm-hmm. then you start feeling like it's something that you really have to do instead of it being something that you really want to do and that you enjoy doing. So yeah, I hope that makes sense.
Oh, totally. No, I that all very much resonates with me. I would love to know your process. Like I'm somebody, I've always been kind of a multi-hyphenate. I have a lot of ideas, a lot of projects I want to accomplish. I usually have 2 to 3 streams of revenue at a given time. I've never been somebody who does one thing and then, you know, indefinitely. And that's been really wonderful in a lot of ways, but also very, very overwhelming. And although I have kind of learned like different processes that have helped me kind of ground myself or simplify or prioritize, I still struggle with a lot of indecision. And I would love to know about your process as a creative and as a writer. I would imagine you get flooded with ideas of things that you want to write or create. How do you sift through and prioritize what is the most important thing to do next and what needs to wait? Mm-hmm. I would love to kind of get in your head around that.
Mm-hmm. So I always write down the things that have a deadline because I know if I don't get them done a little bit ahead of time, I get stressed out. And the only thing that really means is that I'm human and I experience anxiety and that I like to be a punctual person and I like to be respectful of people's deadlines as well. And so things that have a deadline on them, I prioritize. Very likely if I have something that has a deadline, it means it's something I worked hard for to get. And so it is a priority for me. Yeah. The other things, like if I get an idea for something that I want to write, I just grab my journal and write it in the moment. If I'm driving, I stop on the side of the road and I might type it in my phone or I might record it on my phone. because there are things that it's not like you could push it till later. It comes in such a way because of the way you've been thinking about it. And it kind of comes like a response to something that came to you, and it just comes so powerfully. So stuff like that, I like to capture in the moment. And then with time, I decide, do I want to include this writing in a book, or do I want to keep it for something later? Like with most of my books, especially with The Only Constant and Welcome Home, because they're you know, chapters and longer pieces of writing.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I would always go back to writings that came to me at different times and say, well, I should include this in here. Like sometimes things come to me ahead of time and then it becomes clear in the present, like, okay, this needs to be here. So things that have a deadline, I always prioritize. Things that don't have a deadline, but they're very creative and they're just part of the work that I do, I absolutely document them. And sometimes what I'll do is if I'm like, I need to put this out there right now, I will literally go into my phone onto Canva or whatever template it is that I'm using for social media, and I'll write it out. And I either post it right away or I'll send it out as a newsletter. Videos, this is how I went viral in the first place. I didn't even sit and write a script. If I had a thought or a feeling, I would just put my phone in front of me before we even, like, I didn't even know what a tripod was. This was in 2016. Yeah. I just put my phone in front of me, hold it, and say what I needed to say, and I would just post it.
Yeah.
So there's a balance that comes that you learn over time. Like there's no right way unless it's right for you. Some people have a process, but what I really want to say is don't overthink it. Like when people are listening to what you have to say, they don't care what you look like. They don't care how much effort you put into looking good. They don't care. Like in many of my videos, I have no makeup on, and many of my videos, I have my hair up in a bun, or but some people feel like they need to take the time to make everything look perfect. And it's like, I think that's one of the biggest problems in our lives, is that we think we have to be perfect before we go for something.
Right.
So learn over time what works for you. This is what works for me. And it might not work for you. You might be somebody who's like heavily motivated by being late on something or like handing it in the very last moment that you can. Maybe that works for you. It used to work for me, but now that I've discovered that like stress is an addiction of mine, I decided to remove that because I don't want to be addicted to stress. I would like to enjoy the work that I do and not just finish it so that it could be done, but finish it so that I look at it and I say, this is great, and I can hand it in 2-3 days before it's due. So that's what I would say for that question.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I am somebody, like, external deadlines are very helpful for me to prioritize, and then, you know, what feels exciting kind of is kind of what's next. And I think the biggest, I was really excited to chat with you because I feel like this past year I went through the most kind of change and uncertainty I've ever had in my life. And it all kind of happened at once, where a lot of things personally, I maybe didn't know where I was living. I didn't know where I was going to be working. My career was changing. And I also had I experienced the most depression I've ever had. And I think it was because I felt like I didn't have anything tangible to grasp onto, where in my past, you know, if I was struggling with something, it felt like other areas of my life were a little bit more stable. But this, nothing felt stable, I guess. And so those external deadlines were taken away to some degree. And I only had, I had to go inward for what was next in a lot of ways, which I hadn't been used to. I had been used to like the world and the work telling me what was next. And it's, there's something really, there was something very dark about the experience of like, I don't know who I am without these, you know, these parts of my identity and these accomplishments, but something very liberating on the other hand, on the other side of it, where all that is left, because these external things are kind of up in the air, is to go inward and really be honest about what I value. And I did, I had to do a lot of kind of internal trauma healing and stuff that I had been putting off and avoiding, not even really realizing it. And I just had to cling to my support system and really getting clear on who that was. So I know a lot of great things came from it. But yes, in those moments where you feel like, I don't even have an external deadline, how do you feel like you ground yourself in those moments, or even maybe in some of the things like your community has shared with you, have how they've implemented some things from your books or anything like that? Where you're like, I don't know who I am or what I'm doing next, you know?
Yes, I think it's so important to be gentle with yourself when you go through times like that. And instead of saying, I'm a failure, I have nothing to do, or I have nothing that's motivating me, just sit with yourself and ask yourself, why is it that I associate not having something that I'm working towards as a failure? Like, where did that come from? Maybe this period of my life is about resting. Maybe this period of my life is about figuring things out. There's one section in The Only Constant, I talk about a woman who reached out to me who said that every agency that she reached out to try to help her to figure out what her brand is and what she needs to be doing, they all told her, well, you need to figure out what you're doing before we can help you. Like, you need to figure out who you are before we can help you. And she reached out to me and I said to her, well, what if you're somebody who's figuring out who you are? Because that's valid too.
Right.
We always think like, if we don't have certainty, if we don't know what we're doing, something's off. And that's valid. Of course you're going to feel that way. When you're used to a routine, when you're used to always being go, 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 your body's going to be like, we're useless. What are we doing? You're going to feel like you're doing something wrong because you don't have a set goal in mind. You don't have like a set hit of dopamine that's going to come, and you're just like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. And it's like, what if you are figuring out what you should be doing in your life? What if you're going through a period of going inward and figuring out not just who you are, but what it is that you enjoy and what's important in your life? And maybe you are going through a period of cleansing. In The Only Constant, I talk about the importance of internal and external decluttering.
Yeah.
So external decluttering, everybody understands what it is, but internal decluttering is when you go inward and you understand all the thoughts and beliefs and emotions and stories and experiences and voices that bubble up every time that you go through something. So you're going through a period where you're not doing any work. What comes up? When you tune into it without judgment and you learn to understand where that discomfort comes from, why do you feel like you're doing something wrong? Like, where did that come from? What was the first experience in your life that you went through that began this pattern of you perceiving yourself in that way? And when you do that, it's not that you're going to fix it just by becoming aware of it.
Right.
It's that you start understanding that that belief system of, if I don't have a deadline, if I don't have something big coming up, then something must be wrong with me. You become so aware of it. And it's like when you have a conversation with it and with the shame that comes up, like something's wrong with you and blah, 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 then you get to a point where you're able to say, okay, this is going to come up every time I try to rest. It's like you learn how to anticipate when these thoughts are going to come up. And when they do, you can just sit with yourself and say, if I had a friend or somebody that I really love who was going through something like this right now, would I tell them they're a failure? Would I tell them? No, I wouldn't. How would I speak to someone I love? And you would speak to yourself with that same level of compassion.
Yeah.
And if you wake up one morning and you're just, because your body remembers things that you don't remember. So even though you might be aware, your body still needs to feel the feeling until it's fully out. And so you might wake up one morning, and even though you know you're not doing anything wrong by going through this period of time where it's a period of hibernation or it's a period of figuring things out, your body's like, I'm feeling agitated. I need to have a tangible plan. I need to know where my life's going to be in 5 years. I need this. I need that. When that happens, you understand that that's just the process that your body's going through. That's right. Not something that you need to be like, something must be wrong with me for like experiencing this right now. So there's one section in The Only Constant that's called Develop Resiliency Through Self-Compassion. And I used to look at resilience as like an ability to snap back into the person that you were before something happened. Or let's say in this case, you're able to snap back into being a very productive person and into figuring things out. But I discovered with time that resilience is not about snapping back into who you were, but it's about snapping forward into the person that you are becoming. So when you give yourself compassion instead of giving yourself shame, then you start looking at what you're going through right now as something that you're getting through to grow into that version of you that you really know you can be and that you really want to be in their existence, in their presence. And so a beautiful way to imagine that is that future you who has everything figured out, which you're never going to have things figured out, but has this part of your life figured out.
Yeah.
Is holding your hand or is right ahead of you and just kind of guiding you. Yeah. And so when you imagine it in that way, it becomes so much simpler and so much easier to sit with the discomfort of not having everything figured out right now, because you understand that that's part of figuring things out.
Yeah. No, that's, it's just, it's really resonating. And I think I have this fear of, you know, I went through this time and then I started taking action based on my deepest values of like, I really have nothing, I don't care what people think. There's nothing left for them. You know, there's nothing left to kind of judge in a way, or for me to be fearful of that, which was really interesting. And I did take steps and, things seemed to happen quicker than I anticipated. I thought I was going to actually have more time to rest and reflect. And I started taking, you know, I have this job with a nonprofit that I really love now. I got my first publishing deal recently. I love doing this podcast. The podcast is going well. And it almost was like, oh gosh, I'm scared to do this again. I'm scared to get wrapped in the accomplishments, even though they feel more aligned with who I really am. And I thought I would actually have more time to uncover more layers without anything around me. And I think I'm just so scared to go back to the burnout and the, you know, overworking and all of that, that I'm even scared of good, authentic things happening. And I think it's just, it's hard to sift through, you know, it's a really weird, if you're kind of recovering perfectionist or overworker, it's just, I feel like it's a never ending strange relationship that I'm always questioning, you know. You have some great quotes about change and uncertainty. And there's a couple that I saw that I'd love to, if you can expand on the meaning behind these. The first one I saw was, accept change before it makes you reject your reality and choose change before it chooses you. Could you just expand on what you mean by both of those?
Yeah. So accept change before it makes you reject your reality. So this is about changes that we don't choose, like a breakup, like the death of a loved one, like getting laid off work, like anything that's taken away from us or that's added to our lives that we really don't want, a chronic illness like my Crohn's. Accept change before it makes you reject your reality means not that you become okay with that change, as in I accept it like, oh, I'm finally okay with it. No, you might never be okay with it. You might never be okay with the loss of someone you love. You might never be okay with having your dream job being taken away from you. You might never be okay with having a chronic illness. But the acceptance part isn't about saying I'm okay with it. It's about saying I see this as part of my reality. I'm not living in denial of it. I know that even though I'm not okay with it, even though if I had a choice, I would never choose this for myself, I understand this is what reality is. That's what acceptance is. That's what radical acceptance is. So I talk quite a bit about radical acceptance and the only constant. And I also talk about grief, because grief is the way to acceptance. So when you think of the five stages of grief, acceptance is the last stage. But we judge ourselves for not accepting things right away. It's the messaging we get, like, get over it. Just, it happened. There's nothing you can do about it. And it's like, yeah, but there's four stages that come before the acceptance. You might be in denial for a while. You might be depressed for a while. You might be trying so hard to change that reality for a while. You might be just really sad for a while. You're going to go through all the stages before you get to a point where you are like, okay, it is what it is, and there's nothing I can do about it. So when I say accept change before it makes you reject your reality, I'm saying see reality for what it is. That's what's going to make your life one that feels like you're in alignment. It's not going to make your life like dandy and happy all the time. That's not what life is about, but it's about being able to carry that change that happened and carry it with compassion. Like, I talk so much about how for the longest time I wanted to live as if I didn't have Crohn's. Like, I wanted to just eat whatever I wanted and not manage my stress. And what I really did was I was rejecting my own body when my body was rejecting something inside of it, you know? Right. So when I was like, okay, this is part of my reality. Yes, I would not want this upon myself, but it is what it is. Then I'm like, okay, how do I hold this change and give it the love and compassion it needs? I take care of my health. I take care of, like, my eating, my stress, the relationships in my life. When you lose someone you love, accepting it is just allowing yourself to miss them when you miss them, allowing yourself to be sad, allowing yourself to honor their memory. That's what acceptance is, because you're seeing that their loss is here. It's real. And so you can do whatever you can do about it so that you could honor their memory. When I say choose change before it chooses you, it's sometimes change is really knocking on your door. It really is demanding to happen in your life. Yeah. And you keep pushing it away. You keep living in denial of it. But at the end of the day, if it's something that really needs to happen in your life, if it's something that needs to walk away from your life, if it's something that needs to enter into your life, it will happen. And so choose it, because the element of choice is so important. Sometimes we reject certain things happening in our lives just because we're like, well, I didn't choose that. I should be the one who chose it. Just like when people say, well, they shouldn't have broken up with me. I should have done it. It's like the element of choice really gives you that false sense of power. When sometimes it's not just about choice. Sometimes it's about surrendering to the things in life that it's the course of life. It's just something that is happening, and there is nothing that you can do about it. And then the final sentence in that, which this was the dedication of the book, embrace change so it can lead you to your authentic life. So these three sentences are meant to symbolize the three types of change I talk about in the book, which are changes you don't choose, changes you choose, and changes you need to make. When you embrace change, instead of looking at it as, you know, that scene in the Barbie movie where Margot Robbie goes, everything is changing. And right. So America Ferrera tells her, that's life. Everything changes. It's just the way it is. And Margot Robbie goes, but something like, I don't want that. And then she throws a tantrum. Like, they show you her on the laying down on the ground with her face down. And of course, we all want things to stay the same because a certain level of comfort comes with them. A certain level of familiarity comes with them. But if we don't go through the changes that expand us into a life of courage and beauty and where we know who we are, we're not just maintaining the status quo. If we don't do that, then we don't live a life that is full of creativity and full of all the potential that we are able to achieve. We don't, but you don't know what you don't know. And so when you start learning about change and you start looking at it as something that you, I hate using the word should, because I never tell people you should, but when you start looking at change as something that you want, and even when you are going for a certain change or going through a certain change that you've chosen, but there's so many changes that need to happen along the way where they make you so uncomfortable, when you develop the mentality of embracing change, then you start seeing the challenges as natural. You start just being aware of them as opposed to seeing them as signs that you need to go back on that change. Like, you anticipate it. You say, oh, this, of course, is going to be hard. It's like picking to go into a program in school that's very competitive. If you say to yourself ahead of time, this is going to be difficult, like, it's not going to be easy. Like, I'm so happy that I got in, but I understand that this is going to be quite the journey. When you talk about it that way with yourself, then the struggle becomes more expected. And
right,
you're just like, well, I'm just going through this right now. Like, this is a very different example, but people who take medicine for their, if they have acne that's like persistent, they'll tell you, like, before the medicine starts working, it's you're gonna, like, your face is gonna blow up, you're gonna get acne everywhere, there's gonna be a purge of some sort. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that's that really what the journey of change is like. There's gonna be this really ugly phase that you just don't want to go through. Right. But to get to that side, you need to go through it. So I forget what the question was. Oh, you asked me to reflect on the quotes. Yes.
Yeah, no, that was perfect. That was great. And you hitting on all of that made me realize, like, the reason this past year was so tough for me is because all of it was change that I didn't choose. Where in my past, I felt, even though control is an illusion, I felt very in control because the changes that I was experiencing were ones that I actively were making and deciding to pursue. And then when I felt like there was a whirlwind of change that I did not choose or pick, that was kind of, it felt like put upon me, I didn't know what to do with it. I had been very used to, yeah, kind of carving out my own path in a lot of ways. And it was just a really, really strange experience. So based on all of the work that you have out there, what have you noticed, any patterns of what people say to you have been the most helpful, whether it was a certain line in one of your books or like a certain tool that they love, anything like that, that you feel like, okay, I can really tell that the collective is resonating with these few things over and over again, anything that you want to share about the feedback that you've gotten?
Yes. I think we've come to a consensus that compassion really is the way. Not judging ourselves, not looking at what we go through, and say things to ourselves like, I shouldn't be going through something like this, or someone like me who knows all of this stuff shouldn't be going through something like this, or why am I not able to do by what I know is best for me? I think we've come to a consensus that that's not the way to live life in an authentic way. The only way to do it is to look at ourselves in the most self-loving and self-compassionate way. And that looks like looking at every version of us in the past that we're ashamed of every version that we say, I never want to be that person anymore, or I was so weak back then, or I'm never going to be somebody who's hurt in that way. I'm never going to allow somebody to treat me in that way. To look at those parts of ourselves and say that never again is very, very protective. It's not something to be ashamed of, to say, you know, I'm somebody who doesn't want to be a person I was in the past. Of course, you're not trying to reject yourself. You're trying to protect the part of you that, if that part were to have a voice, it would tell you, I was doing the best I can in the moment. I thought I couldn't survive doing any more than this. When you have a conversation with that part, you're seeing it, you're hearing it, and in a way, you're bringing yourself together. So don't judge the parts of you that feel ashamed. Have a conversation with them. Don't judge the parts of you that say, I want to be a completely different person. I want to be strong. I want to be powerful. I want to be cold to people. Don't judge those parts of you, because those parts of you are just trying to protect you from a certain pain that you either felt or haven't felt yet. And they need to be heard and seen by you. At the end of the day, we all have two core needs: to be ourselves, to be authentic, and to be connected to people. And sometimes when we prioritize connection, we let go of who we really are. But the journey into our most authentic selves involves the biggest dose of compassion. It involves the biggest dose of understanding. It involves the biggest dose of being our own advocates. Sometimes when we're really angry about the way we treated ourselves in the past, or the way that people treated us in the past, it's just a way for us to advocate for ourselves. But it's just how you see it. You either get stuck in the anger and say, why am I still feeling angry about that? I feel so stuck. Like, I wish I could go back and just, well, that anger is coming up now because there's a part of you that's advocating for a past version of you. So when you have that kind of approach to your own healing, that's the only way for you to get to a point where you're like, this is who I am. I'm going to be feeling broken on some days, and I'm going to be healing on some days, and I'm going to be doing so well and amazing and just on top of the world on some days. And on some days, I'm going to feel like I need to spend some time with myself and with past versions of me that are really sad over something. And that's, all of those versions of you are okay. That's part of living an authentic life. But the road to that is compassion. And the reason I say that this is the consensus is, ever since I started this work, the number one comment I get from people is, thank you for putting into words what I've been feeling and thinking for so long. Mm-hmm. Thank you for having such a gentle and soft approach. And to me, it is an approach of tough love, but the focus isn't on the tough part, it's on the love part. So self-compassion is the way through change. And yeah, maybe that's it. Self-compassion is the way through change.
Beautiful. I love it. Najwa, thank you so much. Is there anything else that you might want to leave people with? And then where can people find your work, more about you, your books, all that good stuff?
Yeah. The last thing I'll say is, don't be hard on yourself with any kind of change you're going through. I know it feels like the weight of the world is on your shoulders, but the truth is, it feels that heavy because it is heavy. And what it needs from you isn't that you continue carrying it and not feeling it and just walking around with it and hiding it. It needs from you to put it down and look at it and have a conversation with it and try to understand why it is that you're feeling that way. So the place that people can find The Only Constant is literally wherever books are sold. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Indigo, wherever you normally buy books. I also narrate the audiobook myself, so if you want to listen to it, you will hear all my stories and the stories of others in my own voice. And yeah, just let me know what you're thinking. I would suggest reading reviews, because the reviews I've gotten so far will really tell you what the book is about and whether it can help you on your journey of change.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you to Nejwa for being on Self Helpless today. Go check out her new book, The Only Constant, and feel free to come over and join my email list. It's called The D-List. You can find it at DelaneyFisher.com. It's completely free. I like to share different gig and media opportunities, a variety of different resources for multi-hyphenates and creatives. And there's some private podcast episodes about different unique career paths and interviews with people doing really cool things. So yeah, would love to have you. All right, everybody, I will talk to you next week. Maybe thank you for tuning in to the Self Helpless Podcast. You can find our Patreon community, merch, and other goodies at selfhelplesspodcast.com. We'd be thrilled if you left an iTunes review, shared this episode with a friend, or post about it on Instagram and tag at Self Helpless Podcast so we can repost you and say hi. Thanks, everyone.